Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The FT.
The holiday pay ruling. Is it quite the bonanza it might seem? How much money should you leave to your children? And how to use salary sacrifice to save tax and boost your income? Welcome to The Money Show, one of the FT's most popular podcasts. I'm Jonathan Ely, and I'll be giving you all the money news this week in downloadable form, with the help of my FT colleagues James Pickford.
Hello.
And Josephine Cumbo.
Hello.
Plus a special studio guest, Emma Burrows, Head of Employment at law firm Trowers & Hamlins.
Hello.
This week, the Employment Appeal Tribunal ruled that overtime payments must be included when businesses calculate holiday pay for their employees. The case was brought by the Unite Trade Union, which says that employees are being shortchanged because of the way employers in the UK had interpreted the EU's Working Time Directive. However, employer organisations such as the CBI and the EEF said the decision, which is still subject to a possible appeal, would increase the costs on businesses and may result in reduced job creation. The government has set up a task force to look at ways to reduce the impact on industry. The ruling will be particularly keenly felt in manufacturing, retailing and blue-collar service industries, where overtime is widely used, for instance, to cope with big new orders or busy periods such as Christmas. However, the ruling did impose limits on retrospective claims. So, what does it all mean for employees and business owners? Emma Burrows, Head of Employment Law at Trowers & Hamlins, joins me now. Emma, welcome to The Money Show. First of all, there were two separate but very closely linked rulings this week. Could you explain for us the detail of those, please?
Certainly, Jonathan. The EAT case needs to be taken into consideration by future employment tribunal decisions. So it's an important decision, but it perhaps has been slightly overstated, as you imply. The cases that were linked and heard together related to the assessment of what pay is for the purposes of holiday pay. They looked at the situation of one group of employees who were working in road construction and another set of employees who are working in the construction industry. And they discovered that those individuals, the claimants in this case, had their holiday pay assessed on their basic pay, not taking into account the regular overtime that they received. The decision is lengthy. It covers a lot of legal ground. But it ultimately came down to looking at the different types of overtime that people are paid. And in particular, it looked at whether or not non-guaranteed overtime should be included within the definition of pay for the purposes of holiday pay, and also whether compulsory overtime should be included within the definition of pay. It did find that it doesn't relate to voluntary overtime, where the employee has an opportunity to refuse an offer of overtime.
Okay, and what about the respective provisions? Because industry was dreading that this would be backdated all the way to 1998 and there would be multi-billion pound claims for sort of holiday pay owed going back 10 years or more. But that's not happening, is it?
No, I mean, it's a very interesting decision and there's an awful lot of devil in the detail. They looked at a number of different issues. The first is that the judgment is very clear that, as in the case of most employment tribunal claims, you can bring a claim in relation to deductions that have been made up to 3 months before the date of the claim. So if somebody hasn't taken holiday for 3 months, then they are unable to claim. They can also claim for a series of deductions, but those series of deductions, individual deductions, can only be divided by periods of less than 3 months. So you can't claim that your holiday last year was at paid at a lower level, and then your holiday in 12 months later was paid at a lower level. You have to claim for a series of deductions that are no more than 3 months apart.
Okay, now that all sounds very much to me like there's not going to be a sort of PPI style claims industry springing up to sort of manage millions of claims for holiday pay owed. Would that be right?
Well, I'm sure many of my legal colleagues will be disappointed to hear that. But ultimately, I don't think that there will be a PPI style industry. However, a number of our clients have already received letters from Unite and another union asking for information, which implies that they are considering bringing claims.
Okay. And some of our listeners may be employers. What do they need to bear in mind going forward? Because presumably now they will need to calculate holiday pay in a different way.
Yes, I think that's the primary issue. They have to consider how they currently calculate holiday pay and how they'll do so in the future. They might want to look at their contracts and see how they label overtime. And they also might want to do a little risk assessment of what the potential claims might cost.
And finally, Emma, most of this would appear to apply mostly to sort of blue-collar, lower-paid workers. And what about in the professions where most overtime worked, I hate to say it, ends up being unpaid?
Well, Jonathan, I'm sure that the sort of overtime that journalists and lawyers do is entirely voluntary, so it wouldn't be covered by this.
Thanks very much, Emma. There's more about the impact of the ruling on our website at ft.com/UK. Still to come on the show, how to use salary sacrifice to boost your income and cut your tax bill. But first, how much money should you leave to your children? The current debate about inheritance tax rather assumes that all parents intend to leave everything they own to their children. But that may not be the case. A few months ago, musician Sting told an interviewer that his 6 children will get nothing from his estate, as he did not want to leave them with what he described as trust funds that would become albatrosses around their necks. Many business leaders, both here and in the US, have openly declared that they intend to leave their fortunes to philanthropic causes rather than spoil their children. Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates has already started the process of divesting his huge fortune. And in a recent survey of over 4,000 readers, the FT found that many of them, too, intended to give money to charitable causes rather than to their children. So, how much is too much? And how do you go about informing your offspring, who might be assuming they'll get everything when you die, that you've got other plans? James Pickford has been looking into the delicate politics of bequests. James, what are the most common reasons for wanting to leave an estate or the majority of an estate to someone other than what you might describe as the natural heirs? Is it about saving tax? Is it a desire to do good, or is it a desire not to want to spoil the children?
There is this belief or fear among the very wealthy that wealth or extreme wealth has a corrosive effect on ambition. And it was nicely put by William K. Vanderbilt, who was the descendant of the US railroad dynasty. And this is a chap who was born into a life of unimaginable luxury. He said it was a real handicap to happiness, his money. It left him nothing to hope for or to seek or to strive for. And so this is a real worry for the very wealthy. And some of them will try and conceal the extent of their wealth from their children in order to protect them. But where it's not just cash, but a business or an estate that's being handed over, there are questions over competence. So are your children up to the task of actually looking after the inheritance that you're preparing to give them? And of course, do they even want to do so?
Is there any sense of where the dividing line between providing and spoiling lies? And also, is this something that's applicable to people who aren't mega wealthy as well?
I think that there's not so much of a dividing line as a type of person that tends to take one view and another over another. The wealth managers that I've spoken to have said that often the self-made business people will seek to divert more of their money elsewhere, will be more fearful of the effects of wealth on their children than, say, the old money, the old wealth, which has done this over perhaps several generations and has something that they want to perpetuate, some kind of asset. And it's also, we should be careful not to overstate the case. As you know, several wealth managers said that the vast majority of people that come into them, the guiding rule is to try and preserve as much wealth as possible. And as we know, that it's quite hard to do that, what with tax and the effects of dissipation.
Are there any legal issues involved in shutting your descendants out of your inheritance altogether?
Well, English law allows you to do what you want with your money. You can shut them out, but it also allows, under the 1975 Inheritance Act, for a list of sort of potentially eligible claimants, which includes your spouse and your children, to bring a case if they believe that it had not been fairly apportioned. And therefore, that makes no distinction between minor children and adult children.
You hinted at the challenges inherent in handing over a sort of business-generated wealth and how that's a little bit different from handing over, an estate that's been in the family for many years. How does the sort of planning process differ?
Certainly, wealth managers say that actually the distinctions there are less important than the process of communication. You have to set up, you have to have a family plan, and you have to get everyone involved in the family plan at some stage. And they say that for either of those categories, you need, when the children are usually university age, so in their 20s, you need to start involving them in discussions about what will happen to the family wealth and who should take responsibility for what. Now, obviously, with businesses, it may be that you need a higher level of competence to be able to take over a family business in a certain area. Whereas if you're taking a broader responsibility for an art collection or some other historic asset, there may be a wider pool to draw from. But the main thing is that you start this open dialogue as soon as you can and train the younger generation in financial planning and investment.
Thanks very much, James. There's more about the pros and cons of leaving lots of money to children in this weekend's FT Money. This is, of course, part of the Weekend FT, which is widely available on both Saturday and Sunday. You can also read online at ft.com/money or on tablet devices using our new web app. We're always keen to hear your views too. Should the kids get it all or be forced to make their own way in life? Tell us what you think. Our email address is money@ft.com. On to our final item for today. A survey of some 200 employers this week found that around half plan to give their staff more flexibility to sacrifice part of their salary. Why would anyone want to do that? Well, in a word, for tax reasons. Salary sacrifice usually entails foregoing a part of your gross salary, diverting it instead to another purpose. Because you don't actually receive the money, you don't pay national insurance on it, and sometimes you can avoid tax too. Childcare vouchers and the Bike to Work scheme are both based on salary sacrifice. But the advent of new pension rules in April next year has brought another dimension to salary sacrifice, especially for better paid workers. Basically, it's that big chunks of salary could be forfeited and paid directly into a pension fund instead, where they would attract tax relief and then be able to grow tax-free inside the pension wrapper. If widely practiced, this could result in a big loss of tax revenue for the government. But how practical is it? Will your employer agree to it? And what happens if your circumstances change? Joe Cumbo has been looking into the details. Joe, do we have any sense of how widely salary sacrifice is used at present? Some people were advocating it as a way to avoid the sort of taxation of child benefit when that was introduced a year or two ago.
Salary sacrifice is most commonly used for things like childcare vouchers, where you forego part of your cash and that benefit is then diverted into vouchers, and that saves you money on the national insurance contributions you would have ordinarily paid had you taken that benefit as cash. And as you mentioned, it is used also to help people purchase bikes and even season tickets as well too. But for use for pension contributions, it's not as widely known because it is diverting that sacrificing salary into something that is also of a cash benefit to workers. But the reason why it really hasn't taken off is that diverting your cash into a pension means that you're losing control of that capital. Under the old rules, you have to either turn anything that you built up into a pension pot into an annuity, or you're stuck putting that in drawdown. So there has been restrictions which have put people off sacrificing salary in spite of the tax benefits from going down that road.
And what sort of people should be considering this as a sort of pensions planning technique?
Well, the potential tax advantages are really quite chunky. For example, if you were to sacrifice £10,000 of your income, if you're in the position to do that each year and you're earning £40,000 a year, you could make savings of £1,200 per year on national insurance contributions. And over 5 years, for example, that could amount to £6,000. Now, this is likely to appeal to someone who is 55 or over, because as of next April, once you're 55, you will be able to access your pension any time you wish. So effectively, you could put a chunk of money into that pension and access it the next day. And that overcomes the issues of having your capital tied up. For example, you can carry on putting money into, or sacrificing salary into, a pension and access it the next day.
Okay, I mean, that all sounds great. Before I hightail it to my HR department and I inquire about salary sacrifice, what are the pitfalls? What sort of things do you need to take into consideration?
Well, you've got to be able to live, have some opportunity to live with. You can sacrifice that money into a pension, but I guess you'll have to think about how you're going to take that money out, when you'll take that money out, and effectively you will be still paying income tax on that money. So in effect, for most people, it's going to be a deferral of income tax, even though they're making savings on national insurance contributions. You'll also have to think about things, for example, if you're going to go the whole hog and sacrifice all of your salary, how that might impact or affect other personal finance areas that you have, such as mortgage. If you're paying off a mortgage, your mortgage lender might want to know what is happening to your salary, for example. But we're not expecting this to be a fairly a common occurrence for people to put in large chunks of their salary or all of their salary into a pension through salary sacrifice, because the government has limited the potential to do that with a £10,000 reduced annual allowance for people who do use salary sacrifice into a pension.
And how do you go about setting all this up? And are HR departments obliged to agree to it, or is it at their discretion?
I don't think there's any obligation to agree for you to do it, but I'm told that it doesn't cause too much bother for the HR department to set up an agreement for you. It will involve changing your contract. You'll have to agree to a change of terms in your contract, so that will be written down. It's not something that you can do and change your mind too easily about the next day. You have to think very carefully about how you're going to manage this in approaching HR. But certainly you're within your rights to ask your HR department to consider setting up this sacrifice arrangement for you.
And finally, there were, there's been some sort of quite scary numbers bandied about regarding the amount of tax revenue that the government could lose as a result of this particular ruse. Are those estimates likely to come to pass, do you think, or are they wildly
exaggerated? The original figures which have been circulating were that up to national insurance leakage for the government from this, potentially, if everyone aged over 55 took advantage of the opportunity to sacrifice their pension, it could be up to £24 billion. But employers and their advisers have indicated that they are interested, as you mentioned. Then we did get a survey back of employers, and half of the 200 who were polled about whether they would offer their staff this flexibility said, yes, we're interested in doing this. So that suggests that while it may not be £24 billion, that if even 10% of that was achieved, £2 billion as is being suggested, that is quite a lot of tax leakage for the government. And I would suggest that perhaps after, not before the election, but after the election, that this is an area that the government may wish to revisit.
Joe, thanks very much. There's more on the pros and cons of salary sacrifice in this weekend's FT Money. We also look at Japan's latest bout of monetary stimulus and how to make money from robotics, and we've got the first property predictions for 2015. The Money Show will be back next week, but for now it's goodbye from me, James, Joe, and our special guest, Emma Burrows.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.